Thank you so much, Sultan, for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know we only have about 30 minutes today, so I want to jump right into it. For those people who aren't familiar with you, could we just start by giving an intro on who you are and what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you mentioned, my name is Zoltan Ishvan. Most people know me as a public figure in the transhumanist world, and transhumanism is a international social movement of millions of people that want to use science and technology to radically modify the human species as well as modify human experience. And beyond that, I'm, you know, formerly a journalist in National Geographic, still write quite a bit, and a father and a husband and all those other normal family things. So kind of a mix of a lot of different things.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool intro. You're obviously working on things that not a lot of people are thinking about. And I think from your perspective and mostly from mine, most people should be thinking about because it's the future and it's not too far ahead. So I want to start actually before you got into transhumanism. You had a pretty untraditional story. I think early in your 20s, you went and just sailed around the world for several years, actually. Can you talk a little bit about like what got you started on this very different path of life?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I was young and I wanted to travel, but I was really into reading. And so I was looking for a way to take all my books with me. I had about 500 books. And, you know, when you start thinking about the best way to travel the world, it's really, and carrying a lot of stuff, it's really through a sailboat. And sailing is actually really cheap. So I bought a 25-foot sailboat, a Pearson Commander. It was like made in the 1960s and rather seaworthy, but very small. But that said, it was very cheap. You know, the boat itself was something like $2,700 US dollars. Boats, if you don't know, small ones are cheap. So you can actually take a lot of stuff with you and have what I would consider is a floating apartment. And then I spent the next 7 years essentially sailing around the world. My boat is still in Greece and enjoying, you know, enjoying just traveling around all over the place. But really, I see it more as a floating apartment in order to explore and carry my books.
Well, it's interesting because you started with a floating apartment and now I understand you're involved with the Seasteading Institute, which is about float more like floating cities and floating countries even. Is that kind of the initial trigger that led you to think about the possibility of kind of living on the water was the sailing experience or kind of unrelated?
You know, I mean, I think it is kind of unrelated, but I got to say you spend so much time out in the open ocean and you realize like the main thing about the open ocean is total freedom. There are days and weeks where you have no contact with anybody. I was alone for much of my trip, but it's also just the idea that you can do out there, do whatever you want to do, think whatever you want to do. There's no, once you're, you know, I think 200 miles off the coast, there's no legal restrictions on what you do. So, you know, seasteading is this idea, the sort of libertarian platform where you get to take your vessel or your floating platform and just create amazing science or amazing worlds, or there's no gambling rules, there's no, you know, whatever you want to do. It's your world out there because international law doesn't apply to it. And you know, I like that sense of freedom. And I think seasteading is a great way to explore that. And let's just be honest, you know, the ocean is free, whereas anything else you have to build somewhere else, you have to buy it. So if you can build something that floats, you're going to have a rent-free property for, you know, for decades to come.
Right. So, I mean, obviously you went and set sail with several hundred books, a very unique way to start one's kind of path post-graduation. And you certainly haven't gotten any less unique since then with the movement that you're promoting and all the things you've done kind of on that mission. I want to talk a little bit about how you went from the former to the latter. So I heard the landmine story, but you might be able to share that for people tuning in. But it's one kind of interesting thing that I took away from learning about your story was that you actually basically invented this sport I read called volcano boarding, which is like seems extremely dangerous. And then you're going and you're reporting in war zones, you know, as a journalist. And then you're also, you know, this one specific story, which maybe you can tell you're covering people digging out bombs in Vietnam who, and they're often, you know, losing limbs as a result of this or even dying. So you're like seemingly going out of your way to, you know, risk your life. And it seems like you actually are placing, you know, I don't want to like try to get in your head, but like, it seems like you actually don't have that much value or appreciation for life at that point. And maybe you do. But at the very least, you're not like appreciating the risks of these things you're doing, perhaps. So how did you go from like that to actually the most important thing of all time is I want to live as long as possible, you know, as healthy as possible. And if that means being something beyond humans as we kind of know it now, and you know, the various promotions of transhumanism, the technologies that you're excited about, how did you kind of go from the one mindset to the other?
Well, I began, you know, as a journalist, and I think what happened is I was on the sailboat, and I had an opportunity to work for National Geographic, and that really gave me a visual into a lot of different things. I mean, it's one thing to sit around the world, just enjoy yourself and see different cultures and surf and stuff I was doing. But when I was working with National Geographic and using the boat as a base, I really got to see a lot of things. Like, for example, I covered the Olympics in Greece. I covered shamans in South America. I mean, I covered a whole bunch of environmental stories as well. And one of the stories I was covering was bomb diggers in Vietnam. So, you know, America dropped like gazillion amounts of bombs on that country. And in the demilitarized zone, like 10 to 15% of those bombs never exploded. So there's an enormous amount of metal built, you know, stuck in the ground, that is, the jungle is overgrown. And so what happened was, I covered the story of farmers who were giving up their day jobs of picking, you know, plants for like a dollar a day, and going into the forest, the demilitarized zone, with shovels to dig up these big giant, like 10-foot bombs. Any bomb that you dig up that's like 10 feet is worth $1,000 in terms of the what the metal is worth itself, but you have to dismantle it. So you have this entire culture of very, very poor farmers giving up their very poor paying jobs in order to kind of go win the lottery. Now, the problem though is that in the demilitarized zone, it's filled with landmines. So even if you find a bomb and dig it up safely and disarm it and sell the metal, you have a good chance of either exploding in the process or stepping on a landmine. And so my National Geographic story was about that. But I had a very close call with a landmine myself, where my guide pushed me out of the way and showed me what was half buried in the ground. And I was lucky in that moment not to die, but it got me really focused after covering some conflict zones and war zones for National Geographic, that if there was a movement out there not about not dying, and of course I'd already known about one as I was going to college, transhumanism was that kind of its main goal in life, is to not die. Now, it may seem like I was doing dangerous things, but when you're young, you feel sort of invincible. But you're right, you probably don't have an appreciation for death. I certainly have a much deeper appreciation for fear and death now that I have a family and I'm almost age 50. But I think the reality is, you know, I still believe that it's worth taking chances to make sure you actually are enjoying life and having an exhilarating, worthwhile life. And I still believe that. But, you know, these thing with the landmine in Vietnam caused me to move my interests into transhumanism. And that led to me writing a novel called The Transhumanist Wager, kind of partially based on some of my experiences as a National Geographic journalist. And, you know, lo and behold, the novel did really well, became a bestseller, and sort of launched my career as a public figure in the transhumanist world, where I've now been about 7 years, kind of just writing a lot of articles, appearing on TV, doing interviews, and also, of course, running as its 2016 presidential candidate, and also other you know, political races. So that's sort of how I got from National Geographic and the boat to where I am now, which is, you know, I guess 10, 15 years later, you know, I guess sort of leading this movement, trying to be partially at its face and telling people about what's going on out there, that we can overcome science and death through science, you know, through we can overcome death through science and technology. And we just need more people to believe in that and to know that, to support that.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting transition. And I think, like, to your point, there are certain aspects in life where you do want to take some risk, ideally, you know, with something less than your actual, you know, life and death. But like, I think of like, I don't know if you saw that documentary Free Solo, where the guys are climbing the walls, or the mountains rather, with kind of no support. And it's like, you know, every year they're dropping like flies and they're dying. But when they do accomplish the feat, it's like, you know, there's nothing like it. And I get it that there's like this thrill seeking, you know, dopamine, whatever it is, rush of life that's, you know, you have to flirt with death to maybe get it. But for me, it seems that there's, you know, maybe a medium in there where you're risking something, but not like totally actually dying, like in your 20s. And it sounds like you've kind of developed that appreciation over time from like the volcano boarding to more where you are now. You mentioned, you know, looking for a movement that lined up with this kind of new perspective that you got after the landmining incident. And you said you had like been familiar with the transhumanism movement going into college. I saw it like you studied philosophy and religion, I think it was, in college. How does, like, you know, philosophy obviously ties in very strongly and like was a core to your book, The Transhumanist Wager, which you mentioned. But how does like religion tie in with transhumanism? How do the two, it seems that they kind of butt up head to head a little bit, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to say atheist, and it's more than agnostic. I'm kind of just simply someone who thinks the idea of a higher power or a God is definitely unprovable. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I think we've built entire cultures around religion, and I worry that that has totally affected the human race's ability to you know, get involved in science and whatnot, because there are many conflicts between science and religion. Religion wants you to, you know, beg for forgiveness. Religion wants you to use faith over reason, whereas science uses the scientific method, which is we test things again and again, and we use only logic. So there are some conflicts there. And of course, I studied a lot of that stuff. I got to say, a lot of my studies at Columbia University that were in religion were in Eastern religion. So it does apply differently. Like Buddhism and transhumanism go very, very well together. There's very few conflicts at all, because Buddhism believes that the world is a void and you can sort of do whatever you want to do in it. Where it's really the formal Judeo-Christian or Abrahamic religions that are much stricter and much more fine-tuned in their terminology and saying, look, you know, there's a heaven, a hell, you know, there's black and white and these kinds of things. And that's where transhumanism gets bogged down in those Abrahamic religions. And mainly it's because they're so, the Abrahamic religions are so strict in saying it's either this way or no way. And transhumanism is very open-minded. I mean, transhumanism, we have no idea what's going to happen to the human species. We might become cyborgs in 100 years. We might become pure data just uploaded into computers. But whatever it is, it's very different than the message that was given in the gospel, where, you know, Jesus died on a cross and said, you know, just be good people and you'll get to heaven. If we're cyborgs, we may not die. If we're, you know, good and evil might change substantially as we have a hive mind and we're interconnected, and can you be that evil to yourself? I mean, there's some very deep philosophical questions, and yet this is the challenge of religion and transhumanism facing off in the future. And, you know, it's not only a challenge, it's also something that can be very interesting to watch it unfold. It's not like I'm against it. It just happens to be that there is absolutely a conflict right now between those who believe in fundamental Abrahamic religions and those who are secularists like myself and believe in transhumanism.
Do you think that the Eastern countries, like, you know, China or India, wherever it might be, places especially that are majority Buddhist, that they could have an advantage actually in like the scientific realm and in, you know, achieving some of these technological feats that you talk about versus Western countries that may be a little held back by general, you know, even if you're not religious, but if you live in America, there's kind of a norm that I think is created by living in a country where, you know, the president still swears on the Bible, that it's kind of all around us. Is that something that you've thought about at all? I don't know how global, I know you've done a lot of work in the U.S. I don't know how global your movement's been.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because you began this question by saying, do you think, you know, there's this issue, and I don't think it anymore. I know it. I mean, China is hands down now leading the transhumanist world forward. 2 years ago, this wasn't the case. We're still kind of head to head, but they are moving first. They had the first genetically modified children born on planet Earth. They have huge budgets for artificial intelligence. They have as many engineers in China as we have people almost in America at this point. So they are, and they don't have the religious restrictions. For them, it's a, you know, it's a Buddhist Confucius mentality, which again is very open-minded. It doesn't say that science is bad or living forever is bad. It just says, look, you know, try to be good to your common person, your neighbor, and let's improve the world. And that's what science and technology is about. So you have these Asian countries, specifically China, that are just taking off. And I have no doubt that they're going to lead the world forward in terms of transhumanism, because besides just having a culture that welcomes it, you know, we have religious presidents, and they're, you know, you have people like Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, who's 100% against genetic engineering and would probably put a moratorium on it if he could. I mean, what do you, this is potentially the most important science in the country, in the world, that we can actually change. We can stop cancer through genetic modifications. We can do designer babies at some point in the future that don't age or that are, you know, don't have Down syndrome and stuff like that. We can make the world perfect. But if a religious person is against that for their religious reasons, then it'll be sort of like, you know, George W. Bush, who stopped federal spending on stem cells. And so what happened with stem cells in America? Well, for 7 years during his 2-year term, I mean, stem cell basically died off in America, and that technology went overseas. And, you know, now stem cell technology is one of the most important technologies out there. But we had a religious president who essentially stopped it in America for 7 years, and lives were harmed and most likely lost by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, because of that single decision of George W. Bush being religiously against stem cells.
Right. So, you know, it seems that you're very convinced that the U.S. is at a disadvantage. I'm curious why, you know, you've run for president now a couple of times with, you know, I don't know what the difference was in, you know, marginal success between the 2016 run as I think the Transhumanist Party, and then more recently this past election, you actually tried to get the Republican vote. In between there, you ran for governor of California as part of the Libertarian Party. Why do you keep running for office in the U.S. if the U.S. is kind of, you know, it sounds like from your perspective in the global race, at the speed at which things are moving, the U.S. may or may not be like a lost cause, and yet you keep running for office. I imagine with the idea that it can generate some publicity, but also, you know, down the line, you might actually have more of a chance, especially in like a state election or a local election or something like that, as, you know, an intermediate step. If the U.S. is kind of too far behind, what's the motivation behind these runs?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do hope one day I might win, and I'm not sure what party it'll be, and I might run for the Democrats next time, frankly. What I'm doing is, as someone who already has sort of a name and somewhat of a large social media following and am in the press a lot, I can run for an office, and I try to establish what I think is candidates who run on basically a scientific policy. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a shame that you would have these presidential debates and not hear anything about artificial intelligence, not hear anything about genetic editing, not hear anything about robotics. I mean, these are some of the biggest things that are taking over you know, our world, and technology and science historically have a place of being the most transformative experiences that people go through in their lifetimes. And yet our presidents don't talk about them. And even our governors a lot of times don't talk about them because they are not very good for voters. Voters tend to get freaked out when you talk about robot nannies, or you talk about designer babies, you talk about artificial intelligence controlled drones fighting wars far off. I mean, it scares people. So you can't really win votes. But I don't run to win votes, at least not yet. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd love to. I got 6 in the Republican primaries this last time when I ran for president. I mean, I ran because I wanted to. I thought I was be a better president than Donald Trump. It's pretty simple. And I also ran because I thought the Republican Party could use hearing about science and technology more. I'm not a very good conservative by any means, because I'm so liberal in my thinking. But the reality is that I thought the Republican Party, it added a good balance to have a candidate who was a public figure who would talk about science, which is something Republicans don't do. And, you know, we broadly did get some national news, and that was interesting, I think, for those Republicans out there who heard about it. And you know, therefore, I would consider that progress. And that kind of progress is what I did with the Libertarian run, what I did in the Transhumanist Party run. I make progress. People hear about transhumanism. They hear about science and technology. I'm an optimist on it. And hopefully they decide that this is something that's worth following. You know, if you take environmentalism, for example, it didn't just happen because, you know, people decided one day not to cut down trees and to recycle. It happened because there were people at the forefront in the early, you know, 70s really pushing it forward, saying, look, this is going to grow into something major. And I'm hoping that, you know, in 10, 20 years, transhumanism will grow into something like environmentalism. And I will have done my part to alert the public that we can have a better life through science and technology. But it requires politicians thinking about it, requires, you know, people giving their resources to science and technology. It doesn't require like all the chaos or far off wars or the other kind of BS that a lot of humanity is engaged in. What it requires is a war against cancer. You know, the way we've bonded against coming up with a vaccine against coronavirus, that how I think transhumanism can work in the future, except we can tackle aging. We can tackle the world's number one killer, which is heart disease. We can tackle Alzheimer's and diabetics. So those are the reasons I run these campaigns, in an effort to slowly help push this entire movement forward, so one day we won't have disease and suffering.
Right. So, and I'm very, you know, supportive and excited about the possibility to go after aging directly with a lot more attention and a lot more funding, similar to like what you said, the way that we've responded to the coronavirus. You know, my first guest on the podcast was Aubrey de Grey. I don't know how familiar you may or may not be with him, but I'm curious to hear, you know, obviously this is a core tenet of transhumanism, which is, you know, eternal life, or at least, you know, before we get there, maybe being able to extend life, to slow aging, to stop aging, and then to reverse aging, so that, you know, I think the oldest anyone's lived that's been like confirmed on record is somewhere in the 120s. And, you know, it could be that generations like yours or generations like mine could be living regularly well past 150 with possible, you know, changes along a few avenues of aging that can just, you know, like you said, eliminate heart issues, cancer, Alzheimer's, and rather than going one by one, actually, you know, putting off aging in a way that all of these issues come way later in life, and actually people have an easier time dying as well when the time does come. But, you know, going the even further route, or eternal life, or actually whichever one you kind of prefer, life extension or eternal life, how do these, like, you know, day to day, are you actually thinking, you know, are you planning and acting in life as if you're going to live forever, or as if you're going to live until you're 200 or something like that?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not. And I'm, you know, I know Aubrey, and we're friends, and I don't know if him and I will will make it, because we're missing that. We're, you know, we're both like in our 50s or close to it, and we're at that cusp where we probably may or may not make it, depending on what happens, which is too bad. But I definitely think my kids will make it, unless some kind of cataclysmic thing like asteroids happen, you know, hits a planet or whatever. But there is a possibility still at age 47, I could make that cutoff. You know, I'd probably do something like cryonics or whatever. There'll be other methods by then as well. But, you know, right now it's hard to know. And I can tell you that that's a very weird place to be in, to be fighting for something that I don't even know if I'll participate in, but everyone else will. And I think one day they're going to look back and say, well, wow, we're really happy that other people saw this at first, this idea that we can live forever. Cause that's really what this is about. I mean, there's no question we can do this. No question that we're going to find the tools someday to live indefinitely. The human body is like a car. It just needs to be made to run indefinitely. The question is really how fast do we get there? And that's a matter of resources. You know, if we took all the funding from building nuclear arms and put it into life extension science, I bet you within a few years, we would have made decades worth of progress. But unfortunately, right now, we spend such a tiny amount of money on these things that it just takes forever. And one day we're going to look back, when we all do live indefinitely, and say, wow, why didn't we hurry to this process? We would have saved that many more, you know, essentially hundreds of millions of lives.
So obviously that's like the ultimate goal, or at least one of the larger goals and the more ambitious ones. What are existing technologies like in the transhumanist realm that are, you know, they're not speculative about what might be here in 10 years or 5 years or even three, but these are things happening today that you're aware of and you're spreading the word on, but, you know, common people just have no idea is already happening. And then with those certain technologies, how are you seeing them like kind of extrapolated into the future in terms of what's next?
Well, you know, I think the most important technology really on the future, you know, most people die from organ failure. So there's a lot of companies that are working on either 3D printed organs or synthetic organs. And so for me, like my father died of heart failure. So what we really need is a better heart. You know, you can do transplants, but there are just not that many available, and they often don't work. And what you really need is a transplant of something synthetic. And so there are companies working on that, trying to get those into people that would allow them to live longer. Because essentially, it's pretty easy to keep people alive these days. The problem is, can we keep them alive in a fashion that's actually worth living and not just in a vegetative state and stuff like that? So synthetic organs are probably the most important thing moving forward in terms of that. Now, but there are a lot of other, you know, treatments like stem cells, the idea they're now giving injections to people who've had heart attacks to regrow parts of their heart that have been damaged from heart attacks, and then heart attacks again being heart disease being the number one killer in the world. So that those are, and then you have people like Aubrey that are working on the actual chemistry of either reversing aging or stopping aging. And so we have different types of genetic treatments and stuff like that, that are also coming out. And then, you know, finally you have things like mind uploading, the Elon Musk Neuralink stuff, which that's the most sci-fi of them. And that's pretty far away. And we don't even know if that's really possible, but this idea that you might be able to upload your thoughts into a machine someday, you know, but in terms of where I'm at, I think synthetic organs in the next 10 years actually have a marked effect on the longevity of people as it becomes more commonplace to replace poor organs. Like coronavirus is a classic example. You know, it's essentially a respiratory disease. If we didn't have the respiratory issues, we really wouldn't have much of an issue with it. So if we had fake lungs or synthetic lungs that we could stick in, and there are companies working on this, then we would not worry so much about this plague. But right now it's not commonplace to do different types of, you know, and putting in bionic lungs. So we have these issues, but this is just a kind of a sample of how transhumanism thinking goes, is replace parts in the body with better and improved parts.
Right. Well, look, I know you're short on time today, so I appreciate you taking what you had and sharing it with me. It's been fascinating just talking about these few things, and hopefully we can do it again some point in the future. In the meantime, would love if you could just share where people can go, you know, follow you online, follow the movement, learn more about you and what you're doing, everything like that.
Sure. Well, yeah, thank you. Sorry about the shortness, but if you want to find out more information, you can just, I think it's easy just to Google. You know, the fun thing that's happened in my life last 5 years, I've written, I think, 230 opinion essays. So from the New York Times to all over the place, Vice, whatnot. So any topic your listeners have, just Google my name and that topic, and you'll probably find an article that I've written about it. Of course, my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, is out there, and that's really kind of a good read on everything of mine. It's on Amazon. But, you know, and the most interesting thing that happened in 2020 for me, actually, is the feature documentary on my work called Immortality or Bust came out. And that's a long documentary on my 2016 presidential campaign, driving the coffin bus around the country. It's on Amazon Prime. It's also in a whole bunch of other formats, but if you just want to find it, it's on Amazon Prime. You should be able to watch and download it, as well as Apple, iTunes, all the other stuff. So watch that, Immortality or Bust. But, you know, just Google or go to my website, Zoltan Ishvan, for more information. But yeah, thanks so much for having me on.